For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Like I said, my name is David Sayers. I'm a follower of Christ. I'm recovery director at Real Life Ministries in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Anybody ever been to Coeur d'Alene before? Have you? It's a nice place, huh? It's a beautiful little tourist town in the Panhandle, Idaho. Our downtown is right on a lake, and one of our campuses is about a mile from there. I'm also still an owner of Coeur d'Alene Drywall, believe it or not. I still do a little drywall in my spare time. And I'm also a recovering addict and alcoholic. I was a meth addict for about 10 years and an alcoholic for over 35 years. And even though I'm clean and sober and a Christian, I still ride a Harley. And I still love my Harley. This is my wife, Denise.
Hi. No, totally. Don't you think Jesus would ride a Harley if he was still walking? I don't know. Maybe. So I am Denise Sayers. I am his wife. And I am, first of all, follower of Jesus Christ. That's what makes my world go around. I've been a recovery coach since 2003 at Real Life Ministries, and Celebrate Recovery is what we do. I'm also a special education teacher, junior high level. I do extreme sports, extreme teaching. And in 2006, I got my master's in autism spectrum disorders. I am a recovering addict, alcoholic. 2 weeks before I turned 19 years old, Jesus walked into my life, and I was honestly, truly set free from heroin, cocaine, alcohol, destructive behavior. And my claim to fame, I am called Nana by these three fantastic people. And there's really a story behind this, because I met Jesus and was set free in 1977.
Whoa.
And then, I know, before the room was born, I'm okay with that. But then in, no, 1977, what did I say? You guys, our plane was delayed. We got here at 4:30 this morning. So if I'm talking in circles, that's all it is. In 1997, I had a 5-year relapse. And that really is what brought me into recovery. But this is my daughter, Sarah, and my son, Brent, and their spouses, and these are my daughter's kids. And so both of them, for 5 years in their life, at a really important time in their life, their mom went from being a Jesus freak to being on drugs again and alcohol. And this is just a true picture of the restoring power of Jesus Christ. They both love Jesus. They serve him with all their heart. They're both on staff in churches, just kind of coincidentally. I don't know why that is, but there is absolute healing when everything was falling apart in my life. And so that's our Jesus. Dave?
Thank you, Denise.
You're welcome.
So obviously we're here to talk about the opiate crisis, which is taking our nation to its knees. It's growing so rapidly. It's mind-blowing. I just want to let you guys know, both of our pasts, I was hooked on meth really bad for a long time. Like many other people, lost everything, lost a lot of weight, full of scars, played the whole game. We're just blessed to be here and being part of this, even though it's here in a kind of a really heavy reality. The opiate crisis in America is one of the most deadliest plagues we've ever struck our nation. And listen just to some of these comparisons. And this is in 2016, because it takes a couple of years for the records to catch up. But in 2016, 64,000 people died of overdoses in this country. That is a huge number. Coeur d'Alene has 50,000 people in it. We live in the next town right next door. It's got 15,000 people in it. That'd be like, for where we live, I put into perspective, two towns of that quantity amount of people have died in 1 year from opiates. That's just, it's hard for me to even wrap my head around that. Which is more casualties from the entire Vietnam and Iraqi wars. Early estimates say death rates in 2017 are going to climb by another 20%. So as followers of Christ, how do we respond to this? We're going to cover three areas tonight. We're going to start off with the problem, go on to some current treatments, and what we're doing, our own personal journey that we're on, what we see working, what we see don't working. So I've just got to keep in mind that we are not doctors. This is all stuff that we, some of the data on some of the drugs that are used are obviously not our information, but most of it's our personal experience. Daily death rate, 115 to 175 people a day are dying for opiates. That is equivalent to a 747 crashing every single day. So you know, what would happen if a plane was crashing every single day? I think there'd be a whole lot of action happening. And there is some action happening right now, but we need to do more. Like I said, in 2016, 64,000 people died from this drug. Leading cause of death for people under 50, opiate overdose. And the numbers, they just get worse. Death rate estimated by 2020 to be 1 million people. 1 million. So this is where, did you have the pass? The
did you guys get fill in the blanks? Yes. So okay. Things underlined here are what's on your...
Yeah, this is where the underline begins on our sheets. These statistics represent humans created in the image of God. Children are especially affected by the loss of a parent, sibling, or grandparent, and I see that stuff like weekly. The trickle-down effect is staggering. I read an article that said that for every person that's addicted to heroin or any kind of drug, that there's about 60 people that are affected. That's not somebody that dies. It's just somebody that's addicted. You know, stealing from them, that can count lawyers, people in the justice system, people in the medical field, probation officers, jailers, cops, every single person, 60 people. Parents are devastated as they bury their children. The opiate crisis brings with it the culture of hopelessness and helplessness. So how can we as image bearers of Christ bring hope and light into the darkness? And you know, I can tell you personally, about 3 weeks ago, actually it was my first memorial that I did for a guy in our town. He's 25 years old. He was a heroin addict. He did not die of a heroin overdose. He shot himself. But he was under the influence of heroin when he shot himself. And at that time, his wife had left him. He wasn't allowed to see his kids. He was out of work, moving into his mom's basement. You guys are probably... How many people in here know somebody that's addicted to drugs or are addicted themselves? Yeah, almost everybody. It's pretty amazing. Anyway, he had no hope in his mind. He felt hopeless. Everybody was ticked off at him. And you kind of get used to these numbers, but when you're doing a memorial and you see the mom there that's like 48 years old, completely devastated, I mean, grief-stricken, which is a word that's way past sad, like it's shaking, can't talk, can't walk, because your 25-year-old son is dead. And that is happening 175 times a day. It's sad, it really is sad. You know, that was such a weird day for me, because that exact same night, which was on a Saturday, when we have our recovery meetings, I baptized a heroin addict that night. So that kind of lifted me out of my, that stuff messes with you. You know, when you're doing a memorial for somebody that young, it's pretty tough. Denise?
Yes, sir. We're going to just look at some statistics real quick. So in 2016, overdose deaths involving opioids was 5 times higher than in 1999. You can see this. And it has been an upward spiral. Again, this stopped officially in 2016. This is the estimate for 2017. And for 2018, they're saying it's about 20% up from where it was the same time in 2016. So we're not seeing any real solutions yet. And this, I know, is a busy slide, but it shows kind of the 3 big waves that have happened. The first one in 1999, this is when Purdue Pharma began aggressively campaigning general practitioner doctors to prescribe OxyContin. We'll go into that more, but it was based on a lot of false information. And just now, with lawsuits coming out, and the courts are now saying they have to open the records, they were fighting that, it's being shown that it was definitely a known thing, that they were pushing something that was very addictive, but they said it wasn't. So this is when prescriptions really started going through the roof, and it came down to quality of life. And so doctors began prescribing in record numbers. I know here you guys are at ground zero. I know a lot of the pain clinics, I mean, they were getting oxys in by the millions. And so that began. And then the second wave was in about 2010. And that's when the heroin overdoses really started going through the roof. I think with the prescriptions, let's face it, taking Oxy or taking heroin makes you feel really good for a while. And it also addicts you physically and psychologically, but definitely physical addiction. And so people that started on legitimate OxyContins and their doctors started seeing, wait a minute, this is really addictive. They quit prescribing them. Well, to buy an Oxy on the street, you're going to pay about $80 per pill, whereas you can get heroin. I don't know the street value of heroin right now. I should, but I know you can get high a lot cheaper if you're buying heroin on the streets.
That's and good so, you don't know that price.
Thank you. I once did, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. So I think those two things are definitely connected. But then what happened starting in about 2013, this is when fentanyl hit. And fentanyl is what's killing the majority of the addicts right now, because fentanyl, there's a legal use of fentanyl, but what's happening here obviously is the illegal use, and it's being produced in China and in Mexico, and it's up to your local drug dealer how much fentanyl he's going to add to the heroin. It's 100 times more powerful than heroin, and this is what is killing people. It's up to the drug dealer, and like, we've listened to some drug dealers talking under anonymity, and they say they just add, they know that people really like the high, and so they, when they have several people die, that's when they know, okay, I got to back up a little bit. And fentanyl really, I mean, back in my day when I was doing heroin in the 70s, people were dying, but nothing like now. And also, people get out of treatment, and their tolerance is way down, and that's when a lot of people, when they relapsed, a lot of people are dying then. So, an interesting fact, it isn't up there. So, the entire population of America is 4% of the globe, of the world's population. America, we have 4% of the population. But America also has 27% of overdose deaths in the entire world. So, you see, there's... they're calling it deaths of despair, according to the United Nations. Americans are, we have problems. Dave.
So I know one of the big questions that, so I mean, I've dealt with addictions for a long time. Like I said, I've been sober for 9 years. But this recent plague of fentanyl that's gotten into the heroin has really opened my eyes to all of it. Numbers coming out there just blowing my mind all the time. And I'm, you guys are probably thinking the same thing that I'm thinking. It's like, how the heck did this even happen? How did we even get here? How the availability? It just seemed to go on and on and on. But so the question is, did the FDA play a role in the opiate epidemic? Nobody in here from the FDA, right? Okay, because I don't have anything good to say about that. FDA originated in 1906 in response to the nation's epidemic of opium-derived drugs, including heroin and morphine. So this problem has been around for over 100 years. It's been killing people for over 100 years, not to the degree it is right now, but it's been around for a long time. FDA approved OxyContin in 1995 with a label that made it appear less addictive than other opioids. That was just not true. That is a flat lie. FDA allowed Purdue Pharma to market OxyContin at less than 1% addictive. Not true. Doctors began prescribing opiates for chronic pain in record numbers. And not in defense of the doctors, but really when all this stuff was going on, the doctors were believing the pharmaceutical companies. The pharmaceutical companies are having all these conferences like here, saying what a good thing it is, people need it. At one point they called it hope in a bottle. Should have called it dope in a bottle, but... So they were kind of naive. They really didn't do their homework. So they're saying, like, sell them, sell them, sell them. Of course, the money, big, big money machine going on there. Pharma was fined $600 million in 2007 for misleading public. It was making billions. $600 million for them would probably be equivalent to us paying about a $35 parking ticket. that meant nothing to them. They just pay it. It's all part of business. Yep. So we said, yeah, so 2016, 64,000 people died. I say that a few times just to so that will sink in. That's 21% more that died in 2015. In 2015, there was 53,000 people that died. So it was 11,000 more in 1 year. And even by more of a comparison, in 2010, it was 16,000. In 1999, it was 4,000. So we went from 4,000 to 64,000 from 1999 to 2016 in 17 years. I mean, that's amazing. 1999 is the year that Purdue began aggressively campaigning doctors to prescribe deadly amounts of OxyContin. And I kind of talked about that. I don't feel a lot of the doctors really knew exactly what they were doing. They were just going by what they were told. They lied intentionally to doctors, politicians, and the public. They created false advocacy groups to make profit, provide false propaganda to encourage especially the elderly and combat veterans to embrace OxyContin. And that video is a good example of some of the propaganda they had. Purdue also used fake advocacy literature such as pamphlets, videos, and social media to convince the public that there was no long-term side effects or it won't affect your quality of life. So we have kind of identified the problem. I think everybody knows what's going on with that. So I'm just curious again, like how many people in here were aware of how big the opiate problem is before they walked in here? Pretty much everybody. I mean, I think they're doing a really good job of getting it out there and trying to address it in the last year, especially. So here are some of the treatments. Detox rehab, I'm sure you guys have all heard of all these. Medical assisted treatment, MAT, I'm not sure. We'll talk about that, how many of you guys know about that or not. And recovery group therapy, like Celebrate Recovery, maybe even AA, and that kind of stuff. So the typical rehab's 28 days. And with opiates, 28 days doesn't even remotely put a dent in any of it. It might be, I'm for it, believe me. 28 days to get people off the streets, get them physically off of it, get them some kind of straight period going on, that's great. But when you get out of the 28 days, you are not cured. You are just barely taking a little chunk off that iceberg. We've got a friend of mine in recovery. He's 26 years old. He went through detox a year last June, and heroin addict for 10 years. And his mom was like, I'm so glad this is over. You know, had a little graduation party for him, and I'm like, it's not over. It is just starting. And, you know, she has had an education over the last year. She could probably write a book. She could almost be standing up here just in her own personal experiences, what she's gone through with her son. So he got out of rehab. He made it a couple months. He was losing his mind. He just like, I want to use. I've never really been a fan of Suboxone, but after seeing what this guy went through, it was like they found him unconscious in his bathroom with a needle in his arm. I said, let's try. What do we have to lose? He's gonna die of an overdose. Let's try Suboxone. So here are some of the pros of Suboxone. It reduces cravings, avoids harsh withdrawal symptoms, and can lead a normal life. Some of the cons, it can definitely be abused. It is definitely addictive, and it keeps the addict on a drug. So all those things sound horrible. But if you're comparing it to somebody dying with a needle in their arm, you know, my opinion at that time was, let's take a shot at it. Suboxone will diminish withdrawal symptoms and cravings if it's used according to the treatment protocol. If somebody's head is not in the right place when they're taking Suboxone, it's not a good thing. They can smoke it, they can shoot it, they can pretty much do whatever they want, they can get high off of it. If somebody's ready and they are looking for a real way to get off of it and it's monitored by a doctor, it can work. I've seen it work. But it's very controversial, and what I'm talking about, this is just my opinion and kind of what I've seen with. I've seen it help a few people more than that. I've heard people come up to me and say, you're out of your mind, Suboxone stinks, it sucks, you know, it's addictive. And I went to talk to a Suboxone specialist, expert, and I told her all that stuff. And she says, like, well, who are you getting this information from? Are they actively addicts? I said, yeah. She goes, well, because if it's not used right, all that stuff is true. This stuff only works if it's used right. So you have to be careful. And it's good for somebody that like hasn't had any jail. They haven't been in any kind of conditional environment where they had a chance to get clean physically. They're like trying to do it on their own, or they can't afford rehab or something like that. So because the symptoms of coming off heroin are pretty bad. And anyway, that's what it's made for, somebody short-term use. The maximum you should use it, and this is even a stretch of my head, is a year, and then a year to get off it, because you have to decrease it super slow. Like, I know a guy that stopped using Suboxone like that. He was sick for 40, I just talked to him a couple days ago, 47 days, puking, diarrhea, aches, pains, but he stopped cold turkey, which is just not the way to do it. You have to decrease it really, really slow over a long period of time. So absolutely not for everybody. I think the guy that I know, I think it saved his life. So I don't regret that. And I only give information to people. It's up to them to decide exactly what they want to do with that. Next one.
So how does it work?
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Good idea. So the way that Suboxone works, say this is your pleasure sensor right here. Suboxone drops a little bit of the opiate in there. It gives you just a little bit, not enough to get you high if you do it the way you're supposed to do it. It's monitored by doctors. They test you. And then once it gives you that little bit, then it closes. So you just get that bit, then it closes shut. So just enough to kind of get you so you're functioning, can still go to work. You can still drive with it, you can operate, you know. It's legal if you're on probation or parole. It's legal to take Suboxone. You know, the courts are all for it and all that stuff. So that's what gives you just a little nippet of it.
Ready for the next one?
Yep. So the next one is Vivitrol. And this one's a little more less controversial. The pros are it's non-addictive, no possibility of getting high, no withdrawals. It's administered monthly it's administered two different ways. You can take a pill every day if you want, which is cheaper. But you know, if you forget to take the pill, it messes up the whole thing. But if you go to the doctor once a month, he gives you a shot, then you're done for the month. The problem with this is I think it's about $1,300 for a shot. The BPA funding covers a lot of that, especially for intravenous drug users, and funding all over the place for that kind of stuff. And you can lead a normal life. The cons are, if you're somebody like Mason, the first guy I talked about that was hooked for so long and having such a hard time trying to get off of it, if he was to relapse on Vivitrol, it could kill him. Because Vivitrol, go back to that pleasure sensor again, that sucker's closed. Nothing getting there at all. So it doesn't matter how much you take, you're not going to get high. So some guys that are determined to get high, even though things closed, they overdose, it can kill them, and it's happened. And I mean, it actually works for alcohol too. Alcoholics do it, use it. You have to be clean for a minimum of 7 days for Vivitrol to work. But Mason's fiance was on Vivitrol. She is now pregnant, and if you're pregnant, you can't take it. So that's another downside of that. But I really haven't seen anything bad with Vivitrol yet. I just haven't. I've talked to quite a few people, have not heard, besides the cost, $1,300 for a shot's a lot of money. So if you can't get funding, you're kind of in trouble there.
And then too, I know you said that alcoholics detoxing, they'll use Vivitrol too. It closes that down. Or
yeah.
Smokers. Or
right.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, then we're on to Narcan. You guys all familiar with Narcan pretty much? That's good. I'm glad everybody's familiar with that. It is a brand of naloxone, and it is a non-prescription drug in 41 states, including Ohio. It saves lives. Anybody around drug users, if you have a son, a daughter, a husband, a wife that is using or you're afraid they could relapse, Narcan will and can save their life. And back to that pleasure seeker again. So that Narcan goes into the opioid. It just sucks the opiate right out of there. So if you're laying on the ground, conscious, unconscious, and like almost dead, Narcan will bring you right back to life. You have to be careful. Sometimes people get pretty angry and violent when they're coming off of it. And that is that's just like a quick cure to get the people to a hospital. Not a cure, a quick solution to get them to a hospital to rehab, because it doesn't last that long. They could be wanting to use again in another matter of hours. So that's just to save somebody's life. They're dying. What do? You give them that, and it'll stop them out of it. So it really has actually dropped the deaths of overdoses down in the last year. The amount of overdoses have stayed the same, but the amount of people surviving it because of Narcan has change that number a little bit, and mostly by first responders. You know, police, firemen, almost everybody's carrying it now. I went to Walmart yesterday to get a prescription for it in Idaho. You need a prescription, but the pharmacist can write you one. You don't have to go to your doctor. I'm not sure why it works that way, but that's how it works. So I went in there, told my name. Usually, sometimes you have to be getting drugs already from that. You know, any kind of, even if it's antihistamine, blood pressure pills, they'll just write you one on the spot. And mine was $125, and I just have it for the church. In case somebody comes in, you get two applications for $125 without insurance, $145. So considering you're going to save somebody's life for $145, good thing to have. So it was kind of funny because somebody in the other breakout session earlier brought something up, which I didn't think about, and said that one of the side effects, or one of the bad points about that, is some of the heroin users are keeping that. Like, I'm going to take it right to the edge, because if I drop, I got Narcan to pull me out of it. I go, man, never thought about that. That's kind of sad. You know, I don't think that's a super common thing. For one reason, I think heroin actually rather spend their money on heroin than they would Narcan, because everything else doesn't really matter. But a good little side thing that I never really quite thought of.
Chasing that high.
Yep. Chasing that high. I've done it. Okay. I'm going to show you about a one-minute video here, and take it with a grain of salt, because I do get some of it, not all of it, but we'll talk about it after we show it.
Some of you have probably heard about the Rat Park experiment, and that's what he's talking about.
In the 1970s, Dr. Bruce Alexander did an experiment. He took some rats and placed them in a cage and subjected them to water laced with morphine. It was their only choice. After 57 days, he took those rats and placed them in a much larger cage with all kinds of things for the rats to do, and placed other rats in there for more interaction. And he gave these rats a choice between the water laced with morphine and pure water. Surprisingly, these rats never went back to the water laced with morphine. Even though they had succumbed to certain withdrawal symptoms like shakes or whatever, they never went back to the morphine. What does this tell us about addiction? Well, it should tell us that addiction is not related to the drug that we choose as much as it is related to the cage that we design and confine ourselves to. What it means for me is that addiction, the opposite of addiction, is not sobriety, but connection.
So I'm not sure what you guys thought about that. I'll tell you what I thought about it. That experiment was conducted in the 70s, and I think it was published in 1981. The hypothesis was that part of the drug use issue with the drug addiction wasn't environmental and not just biological. This helped us explain how 20% of the U.S. Soldiers from Vietnam came back. They were using heroin, and when they came back, they just stopped using. 20%. Physical dependence is when the body will not function optimally without the drug. Addiction is marked by a change in behavior caused by the biochemical changes in the brain after continued substance abuse. Substance abuse becomes the main priority of the addict, regardless of the harm they may cause to themselves or others. And anybody that's ever dealt with an addict knows that they could care less about their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, the employee. They'll steal, lie, manipulate. And I'm not being judgmental, because I've done it too. I know it. And addiction causes people to act irrationally. So the way they don't have the substance, they are addicted to their system. So when they're talking about the cage, and this is kind of where I related to it, I think the cage in this reference means, like for me, my cage right now could be fear of talking in front of people. you know, it could be insecurity. I mean, it could be any number of different things that is holding you back from living a normal life. It doesn't make any difference if you are penniless or if you're living in a $1 million mansion. I think all of us live in some kind of cage. And being outside that cage, and this is kind of where we start changing our philosophy at our church with, like, relationships. Relationships is such a huge part of our recovery, along with all the other stuff. But isolating, like in the first one, I know for me personally, is death. If I start isolating, Satan gets in there, starts gnawing at my brain, and weird thoughts start going on, and I have to get out of isolation all the time. And one of the things that takes me out of there is my relationships that I have formed. So here's a picture of our motley crew last winter sometime, because I have a beard in there. This is about 40 or 50 of the people that are in our recovery group. This is just a portion of them. This is, I kind of call these guys kind of the, these are the guys that come every week. And we do tons of things together. We have, and I'll talk about this more again later too. We do life together. We just don't meet once a week for a meeting. We do campouts and Thanksgiving. We eat Thanksgiving together, all of us. Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas together. We are definitely a band of brothers and sisters there. And you can tell only one guy doesn't want to be shown. He's kind of a high visual guy in the community, so he doesn't want to, his face shown in that. And our four core principles are, number one, relationship, be in a relationship with God, number one. Number two, be in a relationship with each other, which we have. Three, be an active part of the church. Four, honestly and humbly addressing our sin, brokenness, and temptation. So when we screw up, we just come forward and say, you know what, I blew it. I relapsed yesterday. I did this yesterday. I didn't talk good to my wife yesterday. Whatever sin that happens to be, we don't like to keep anything inside because it just festers. And if you're an addict, I know for me, if I keep things inside and they fester, that's death. I mean, that is resentments, isolation, huge recipes for relapse. So one of the things that we've been doing with our group over the last 8 or 9 months is we've been integrating our church groups, our life groups, which I guess you guys call church groups, right? Or
small groups.
Small groups, yeah. Yep. Yeah. So our life groups come to our recovery once a week, once a month. And they cook us a big dinner every last Saturday of every month when we have a testimony. And there's like 15 or 20 of them, and they have grown to love us. We're not in, and we have grown to love them too. They have been, we have become kind of one, and they stay for the testimonies, and they just love the honesty and the rawness of recovery. They love that people get up there and just say, just throw their dirt right out there. I mean, we're kind of used to it. The rest of the people in the church, they're pretty transparent. They've never really seen this before. So they're getting more involved with us, and it's no longer recovery over here, church is over here. And there's still a little bit of that, but we are definitely kind of pulling ourselves together, which is great because we don't really promote people to come. Look how happy they look. There's Shane, my buddy. We don't really promote people to stay in recovery forever. Certain people will be in recovery for, if that's where God's calling them, for 10 years, like me. We'd like to see people go in recovery, get involved in church. 70% of our people in recovery attend church weekly. Most of them are in life groups, probably 70% at least. But at some point, to see them grow and lead a life group and not be in recovery anymore, that's kind of our goal. It's like, move on, you know, let's get through this, not forgetting where they came from. But we don't like to be identified that way. We don't ever want to forget where we came from. But moving to the next thing is awesome. Addictions function in the fertile soil of isolations, like what I talk about. I don't see any isolating going on here. Not to say that some of them might not isolate when they go home a little bit, but we are aware of that and we are on it. Christ-centered recovery offers friendship, acceptance, and loving accountability. Those guys hold me accountable all the time, in a loving way, but in a firm way. Hey, brother, man, you're blowing it. Hey, why'd you do that? Where were you? That kind of stuff. I mean, it's good. I mean, sometimes they talk a little harsh to me, but sometimes I need that. And another good thing is we have our church staff is 100% behind us. They really value our recovery program, and they, like, we have child care. The church pays for that, and they give us a pretty decent budget so we can buy food, we can buy books, anything that we really need. They see the lives that are getting changed, and they're like all in, and like they promote it from the pulpit. And they talk about it, and we're getting a lot of exposure, setting up information tables in the lobby of the church. And people that aren't in recovery are starting to realize that maybe they should be in recovery for something else. Because our recovery program, Celebrate Recovery, is what we have. You can also be in recovery for pride, for anger, for overeating, for gambling, for
codependency,
enabling. Yeah, the list goes on and on forever. That's a good-looking crew, though, isn't it? I'll tell him you said that.
So I think we missed, to kind of answer your question, I do not know how many, what the percentages of people that take OxyContin and become addicted. What I do know is that of the research they've done, 50% of the heroin addicts say that they started on on pain pills. That's not saying 50% of people that use pain pills are going to become a heroin addict. So that would be good information. I'm not sure about that. Okay, this is what we use. We are Celebrate Recovery, and we are, it's a 12-step program. The difference between Celebrate Recovery and AA is our higher power is Jesus Christ all day, every day, because he is the only one that can change my heart and give me a heart of flesh instead of a rock, which is where I came from. So we... on Monday nights, it's when we have our step study group, and it's men with men, women with women. We keep our groups relatively small, no bigger than 12, and we have four books that we work through, and you have homework to do. Although it's not a lot of work or a lot of writing, like the very first lesson is denial. You read two or three pages, and then it asks some questions. You do your homework, you bring it back to group. I mean, some of the questions after reading it, what areas of your life do you have power or control over? Be specific. What areas of your life are out of control, unmanageable? Be specific. How do you think taking this first step will help you? And there's about eight questions per lesson, and you come back with your homework done in group, and you share. Confidentiality and knowing that it's a safe place in that group is at the very heart of what we do. Otherwise, I would not recommend you go. I mean, we all come into these groups wounded. And trust is not something that we have in a big supply. And so the safety of the groups is really a huge part of what we do. And the way we do that is there's five group guidelines that Celebrate Recovery has, and before every meeting we read them. The main one is confidentiality. What's said in the group stays in the group. In fact, who's in the group stays in the group. And going back to that picture, most people don't have any kind of issue being in recovery and people knowing it, but that one did. So that one, we're going to protect his anonymity because it's what we do. So Celebrate Recovery started in 1999 at Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California. It is a very good program. It works. They have good success rates and recovery rates, and we didn't see any reason to reinvent the wheel when it's been invented. So right now, Celebrate Recovery is in over 35,000 churches around the world. It's in most of the prisons now. And California has adopted it in their prisons. New Mexico has adopted it. But again, working through these steps with the same group of people week after week, learning to trust is huge. And when you get through the 12 step, I wouldn't say, "Woo, it's all behind me now," but you've gone down the road a little bit. You've got some tools now. And I'd say more than anything, it gives you tools and it gives you some safe people to get in touch with at 2 a.m. when you're about to lose your mind, and that's really important. I have found that we addicts tend to have kind of a lot of chaos in our life, and so this is a structured program, and that's a good thing. Starting something and finishing it is a good thing. So we make a big deal of it. When a group graduates, we have a graduation at our Saturday night meeting, and we give everybody certificates, and there's a great feeling in finishing something. This is a video. I don't think we're going to play it now just because we kind of ran out of time last time doing it, but it talks about the three doors to Celebrate Recovery, and they are the step study that we talked about that takes 7 to 12 months to work through. It depends on how chatty everybody is. And that's one. We do that on a separate night. And then the other two things we have is our big, large group meeting. We have those on Saturday nights, and that's when everyone comes together, men and women. We have, 1 week we'll have a lesson that somebody, one of the leaders will do. The next week we have a testimony. We worship. We celebrate sobriety by giving out coins. You know, if you have 30 days, come on up, and that's awesome. There's a lot of satisfaction in seeing that we're making progress. And then we break into our small groups, and that's the third door to Celebrate Recovery. That's when we go men with men, women with women, and we try to keep that issue specific too. So having a group of chemical dependent people, a group of men, women, codependent women, we don't have a lot of that yet, but that's the time to do that and get into the issue specific. Our step studies, when we have, that's everybody. Everybody, same sex, same group, comes together. And the reason it's not important that that's issue specific is even though the consequences of our addictions are different, like I got a DUI and when was that, 2009? That was a relapse. I'll talk about that. And I doubt if somebody with a food addiction is going to end up in jail for that, you know. So consequences can be different, but at the heart of it, the root issues of our addictions are all very much alike. We are hurting. We just want to feel okay. We just want to feel normal. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to ruin my life. I want to mess up my wife or my husband. I'm going to make my kids' life miserable. I want to lose my job. I want my parents to hate. We don't do that. You know, people are not out trying to do that. We're trying to feel okay in this broken world. And unfortunately, the lie of Satan has never been louder than it is in with drug addiction, because it sucks our very soul out. But thanks be to God, Jesus Christ is bigger than even that. Thanks be to God. So, this is, some of you my age might remember Keith Green in Last Days Ministries. Keith Green had a huge part in my coming to Christ in the 70s. And he had, this has always stuck with me. This generation of Christians are responsible for this generation of sinners. And I thought, thanks a lot, Keith. That doesn't make me feel good. But you know what? We are the church. We are called by Christ to be light and to be salt to this generation. And I think the message to this is, church, we need to leave the building. We need to be out there because people are dying out there. Now, how we do that, how we go about that, what it looks like, we'll talk about that a little bit. But if God is calling you to that, you pray and He will answer that one in a heartbeat. I'll tell you, a gold mine is getting into the jails. If you go sign up, I don't know how things are here, but just going in, I used to go in for 3 years. I went in weekly to meet with the women, and we had so many people when they got released, they would then come to RCR and they had a connection. And that's really all so many people need. They just need a connection, one that isn't going to take them back down the tube. And obviously, from the mouth of Jesus himself, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And he seeks us, and we're supposed to be his hands and feet. So, you know, I think my mentality of, well, we have a recovery group, and people know, and so they'll come to us. And when they hit bottom, they'll come. God is really starting to really mess with that in my mind and saying, go, you need to go. And obviously, the harvest is plentiful. People are dying daily while we're in here right now. People are dying. And then this is just a picture of the church on the rock. And we're all busy doing pretty important things, but there's a few people that are, you know, trying to help those that are lost. And I was one of those people that was lost. And I had people praying for me, and I had people that came after me and showed me the love of Christ. You cannot cram it down anybody. I mean, it's the love of Christ that draws us. How do you love an addict? And we need to talk a little bit about that, the difference in helping someone and the difference in enabling someone to stay in their addiction. And again, this is, God is calling for street ministries in our time. The Jesus People movement happened in the 70s, and that's when there were literally thousands of people who were on drugs, lost. I was sick. I had Hep C. I was in. And everywhere I went, I'd go into Taco Bell, and there'd be these long-haired Jesus freaks going, hey, do you know Jesus? And I was like, I couldn't get away from people. The church had left the building. And that's when there were thousands of people that were being saved. It was real. It was Jesus. I know this is where he would be and what he would be doing. And as the church, we have a role in offering a place in our buildings where people can come and feel safe and feel loved and not be judged. This is all scary stuff. I know it is. Being involved with people that are addicted can be very messy. It can be scary. And Jesus never said that he came so we can be comfortable. All right. That's it.
Oh, cool. Great. Good job. So I'm just going to talk about a couple of things that we do and how they work. And like I said before, and I'm going to continue saying that, recovery comes down to it. All this stuff is good. The 12-step is good. The big meetings are good. The small group meetings are good. Relationship is good. Discipling people. So it's not just one thing. It's a combination of all that stuff, and you have to do it diligently. Relationship, recovery comes down to relationships. Discipleship comes down to relationships. This is a model most delivered to us by Jesus himself. So this is just some of the relationships that we have built. So this is us at Christmas time in downtown Coeur d'Alene. And there's Mason, heroin addict, meth addict, heroin addict, meth addict, drug addict, heroin addict.
New creatures in Christ.
New creatures in Christ, yeah. Jeremy, heroin addict. He just got baptized about 3 weeks ago. This is a camp out that we have once a year. We just had it last week. We started it 4 years ago with about 50 people. This year we had 300 people there from 15 churches from 9 states. We had speakers from Maine, Hawaii, on and on and on and on. There's actually one more person that got baptized that night at a recovery meeting. Meth addict, heroin addict, heroin addict, alcoholic, alcoholic. So you can see how they're kind of getting transformed. This is a small picture of our camp out. Not too good of one, but... So just more pictures of our camp out and our relationship building stuff. That's me over there talking. This is one of the national directors from Celebrate Recovery who came in from North Carolina and spoke, and he just loved seeing 300. Here's a small amount of the people that are there. Singing, eating, playing. We didn't have any workshops or anything like that. That's not what it was about. It was about getting filled up. We had 9 testimonies. This is our senior pastor, Jim Putman, who is the founder of our church, and he travels all over the world constantly speaking. Very, very well-known person. And he was talking about support of the church. He came to the camp out and talked about his addictions and alcoholism that he struggled with 30 years ago, and his son, who is now a youth pastor, who is a major drug addict. We also had 7 baptisms at that camp out. Another big part of the whole recovery thing, the list keeps going on and on and on, is serving. You know, here's Jeremy and Josh, 2 heroin addicts. They're hauling grills around. They're doing good. We have our band playing. We have addicts running the first aid tent. More pictures over there. Plus we had, 7 baptisms.
And here's one of our favorites.
So this guy, before you play it, this guy is my buddy. He lives in Spokane, Washington. And he runs Celebrate Recovery in Spokane, pretty much homeless people. He's got a tough ministry. And he brought up a school bus full of people up this year, and he always does. All the people lined up on the beach, this is the lake in Idaho, are here to witness the baptism. They're all part of the camp out. So this is actually pretty funny. This is him baptizing one of his guys that he deals with. That was so funny because the water was freezing.
It was cold.
It was so cold. That guy just didn't want to go under. Bob's like, bam, you're going down, dude. we showed it at our church. They said, I think there will be charges filed against Bob for that baptism. Okay. So, yeah, like Denise was talking about getting the word out to the public about our recovery groups. We do go downtown Coeur d'Alene and we knock on doors with our information and invite people to our events. Jails and prisons are good. Denise and I are just in the middle of opening up our own halfway house right now. It's half open. The halfway house is half open.
So it's a quarter house
right
now.
Yeah, it's a quarter house. Yeah. The upstairs is occupied, and one of the guys' pictures we just showed is he's running it for us. Downstairs, we're still remodeling it, and it's taken us a long time because it's pretty expensive to do that kind of stuff. But we've had helps. When you see someone that's obviously in bondage and drugs, reach out to them. I have found out that, it takes a little bit of guts to go up to people and start talking to them, but usually they love it. They love when you reach out to them. They're pretty good about opening up. I'm not saying That happens all the time. When we first started our recovery in downtown Coeur d'Alene, we didn't even have a church yet. We just rented a little office. And it was me and Denise and about five other people. We were all leaders. And every week, seven people. Nobody, not even one new person. So that gets kind of discouraged when you go through this training and all this stuff. So I said, well, let's go down to the thrift store and buy a barbecue, and let's cook some hot dogs out in front of the building, and maybe the smell of hot dogs will attract people.
It did.
Yeah, we cooked 12 hot dogs the first night. We had three new people. It's like, wow, that's people come. So more hot dogs, more people, more hot dogs, more people. You know, 6 years later, we still do it. We've cooked over 18,000 hot dogs. And that was actually, yeah, that was the number last August, last April. So people walking past the church every week know we're there, and it's not about the food. It's just about exposing ourselves, getting a chance to talk to people. And we have had people walk by there inebriated, drunk, or under the influence who have had a hot dog, slowly come into the meeting, slowly get saved, slowly become part of the church. And we have actually seen that happen. It doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. And we will continue serving hot dogs until we are done there. Reaching out to the people, the jails, the institutions, walking the streets. Try to carry a cart with you all the time.
Carry a cart with you all the time?
That'd be fun.
Yeah, that too.
Okay. So I'm going to kind of close with this, which is a little bit repetitive, but that's okay. How do we do recovery and what is important? Accountability, huge. Relationships, huge. Meeting at coffee house is huge. I'm not sure if I already told you, we have Thanksgiving dinner together. We had 125 people come to our dinner last year. The recovery people served the people in the community that didn't have a place to go. I mean, that's fun. We had 15 turkeys. And that was another thing. The church got involved in that, too. They helped us cook. It was awesome. We go to the races together. We have a racetrack in town, and and anything that we can possibly do together, and we hold each other accountable. Conflict resolution, whenever there's an issue, we have to take care of it right off the bat, because we build up resentments and then don't go away, then that just kind of poisons everything. It's really easy, especially in recovery. I mean, everybody's broken. I think sometimes recovery takes that brokenness to a different level sometimes, depending on the people. We deal with some pretty broken people. I'm broken too. I'm not saying I'm not broken, but we're pretty broken, and we never know exactly how we're going to trigger somebody. We say things that tick people off or hurt their feelings. We don't mean to do it. It's real easy to pick up your ball and go home. You know, we fight for our relationships 100% all the time. If somebody doesn't come back, that's because it's not because we didn't try. And even when we're getting ticked off and yelled at and screamed at and sometimes even attacked within. We had a guy just text us the other day that I've been dealing with for 6 or 7 years, throwing my heart into him. And he sent me a text. He said, you and your wife are mentally ill, and called Denise a horrible name. I'm like, really? That feels good. But we don't give up. We keep on plugging. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad you guys came here. We have a few minutes. If anybody wants to ask any questions, you know, for the next 10 minutes or whatever, we would be glad to answer them to the best of our ability. Okay. Anybody have a question? Shoot. Boy, that's a good question. Yeah, love. Never giving up. It's a combination of all that. There's so many tools in that toolbox. Can you get that out of there? Excuse me.
You're in bad shape. Yeah. There you go.
What do you have to say to that?
We were talking about this at lunch, too, that in recovery, there when we go every week, and I love going to recovery, I hate going to recovery, because there's times I just don't want to go be open and honest and transparent, but that's required to do there, because otherwise I'm not being real. And as we model that with other people, that transparency breeds transparency. People want to be around that because there's reality in that. And so it's hard to do, but if we can approach those that are really struggling and dying out there, and not as I am here to help you, but hey, this is how I found help, whether it was with drugs or whatever it was. And then, you know, I don't know. I know some people have had like interventions where the family and loved others come and show up, and it depends where that person is. I never want to underestimate the power of prayer. I had a praying grandma, I had a praying cousin, and there was people praying for me, and so praying for them. It's not as fast as the internet getting feedback results, but it's powerful.
There's also a lot of power, and I got this from you actually, just relating, the power in saying me too. You know, if somebody's struggling with something, yeah, I don't have it together either, brother. I'm struggling. I still do. I mean, I've got, you know, that Harley. Where happened to that picture of my Harley?
I don't know.
I'm supposed to show it. Yeah. So anyway, I still struggle like riding my bike because I did bikes and bars and Sturgis and all that stuff for decades.
There it is.
Yeah. Isn't that nice? Yeah. Thank you. I have to be careful. I don't go out of my town unless I'm with a brother. I'm not saying I would relapse, but why would I even want to take that chance that I'm 50 miles from home, there's nobody from recovery around me, and Denise just had a fight. I see a sign, pull in, game's over. So I still struggle, you know, not like I used to, believe me. Our senior pastor said something one time that really struck me. He said, you don't ever want to combine opportunity and temptation at the same time. So I try not to put myself in a position where I have the opportunity and the temptation at the same time, because if those two collide for me, I won't be standing up here anymore.
But if God would give us inspiration to make a 5-minute video that would strike the heart of every addict and make them, you know, want to change and get help, I would do it in a heartbeat. It's the question we all ask. What's it take to reach that person? And, you know, always before we've said, well, people hit bottom, whatever that bottom looks like. Your bottom is when you give up the shovel. But what's changed now is that so many people are dying. You know, it's like there's an urgency that there hasn't been before about that very thing you're asking.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some other ways of how we can respond to, you know, to those who are, you know, not only are struggling with addiction, but also families, you know. I guess I'll just share this example. Like, you know, in my neighborhood, I know that there's a mother whose child is struggling with addiction, and she has sent her daughter off to different places and tried different things, and, you know, including sending her to California, where she's gotten kicked out of 6 different sober houses. And, you know, she's been, you know, and, you know, and she doesn't even know if her child is coming back here to Columbus, Ohio. So, you know, it's really encouraging to hear your testimony of what you've done here, and I'm kind of wondering, it's like for those people who are struggling out there, what are practical ways we can convey to them, hey, the Christ-centered recovery approach is the way to go. Like, how come, like, you know, I mean, some people may not be familiar with the Bible or different truths to be able to comprehend those things, but what do you encourage us to do here in Columbus, Ohio, to, like, hey, this is, try going this direction, or, you know?
Yep, I do, and it's a good question.
That's a really, really good question. It's a very, very difficult question.
How do we be the hands and feet of Jesus?
Yeah, so you're not necessarily struggling with alcohol, but your friend is. Right? Is that kind of what you're saying? So how do you get them to come to a celebrate recovery or some kind of Christ-centered? I can just tell you what we see. It's worked a couple times, like that guy I was talking about with Mason. He's a heroin addict. He's still not really a believer. He doesn't know what he believes right now, but he's sober. You know, there's people that come in that are atheists. The guy just asked me a couple months ago, I'm atheist. He was in his, can I come to your group? I said, yeah, man, come on in. We love that. That's great. So Mason pretty much got in. His mom, who doesn't have a problem, she brought him in basically, and she volunteers in the recovery. So she kind of got him there to kind of help him out, to encourage him. didn't just drop them off at the doorsteps, but actually stayed and worked in the kitchen and stuff like that. So if you can encourage somebody, and if that means physically taking them there and not necessarily just dropping them off, because it's scary when you're walking into a recovery for the first, I remember the first time I walked into recovery, I left. I was supposed to meet a guy there, and he's like, called me up the next day, he goes, where were you? I said, I couldn't find you, and everybody was really rude. Nobody talked to me. He said, did you ever think about going up and shaking somebody's hand? I said, no, why would I do that? He said, go back next week and shake somebody's hand. And I did that, and he met me there. So, you know, if you could, and it's difficult. It's not easy to say, hey, you want to go to Celebrate Recovery or whatever they have here, Hope. What, you know, I'm not trying to push Celebrate Recovery on anybody. If you can get them in the door, that's like a huge percentage of it. Because once they get through the door, they can see what's happening.
And I don't be afraid to speak frankly to somebody that's an addict. You're going to die if you keep doing this. There is help. There is hope. And I think that it's taken it to the streets. Like I said, people have been there going and saying, hey, the one man that, I can't find him right now, who's the national director of Celebrate Recovery, he tells his story. And there was a man who would go to all of the biker bars and just love on people. He wasn't there to preach. He was really just there to love on people, this guy. And he said when he hit a really low bottom and he didn't know what else to do, he called that guy. So it's letting people know that you love them and accept them as they are, but they're going to die if something doesn't change. It's not an easy answer.
You definitely have to step out of your comfort zone. You know, do things that you don't really feel like doing, but, you know, look what's at stake. You know what I mean? Any other questions before we wrap her up? Yes, ma'am.
I just have a plug. I work for a nonprofit community resource center on the south side of Columbus, which is where opioids are, like, rampant.
Okay. Yeah.
And there is a grant given to one of the partners in the building where if you come, they do this once a month, and sit through a half-hour training, they'll give you a Narcan in, like, a little pouch that you can just
nice.
You don't have to spend, like,
cool.
That's the kind of stuff we need right there. Bam. You just nailed it. Perfect. Do you have like any phone numbers or address or anything like that?
Yeah, I can write that.
That'd be great. I'm leave it up here or something like that. So,
this study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.